Welcome inside the Coach's Room, the number one podcast for football coaches that want to develop. Every week we talk to elite coaches and backroom staff to hear about their experiences, how they develop, and how they develop their players.
It's okay to make mistakes, and it's okay to fail, and we can laugh about it, and we can joke about it, and it's okay, it's safe to do that. And that translates then, I hope, to what happens on the grass. It's got to be an environment where players feel safe when they come to work. They can try things, they can experiment with things, they can fail at times. And so long as learning takes place and that we all get better from it.
In this episode, we talk to Liam Bramley. Liam is the first team coach of Norwich City. And we had a great discussion about clarity. You're going to hear this word maybe 100 times during the podcast, but it was a very interesting discussion. So enjoy this episode with the wise Liam Bramley. Liam.
Good afternoon.
Good to have you in the coach's room, Liam.
Pleased to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation to come and talk to you.
Well, it's good to have you. And you are... You're not in your coach's room, you're in your new home, right?
I'm in my new home, yes. Recently moved in here after the move to Norwich, so.
Yeah, you actually said, okay, maybe it's good to know that as a coach moves, so you move from Aston Villa to Norwich, that also means that everything that everybody doesn't see, like a house, family, whatever, moves with you. More impact than people can imagine, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. This has been a bit easier the second time round because I've done a big move from Newcastle to Aston Villa. Yeah. Geographically, these places aren't close to each other. So I've got some experience of this now, but yeah, it's definitely something that on the outside, I guess people don't factor in. And I have a much bigger empathy now for players when they move from one club to another. I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like moving from a country to another country and the impact that would have on your life and moving everybody, family, kids, particularly if they're in school, the impact that has. You can multiply that many times if it's to somewhere that speak a different language. So I have the utmost respect for players when they do that, given all the challenges that come with it, having faced them twice myself.
Yeah,
albeit in my own country.
Well, we can all imagine how busy it is to be a coach in, well, in your case, a championship, which is more than 40 hours a week. It's more than, it's almost double full time. And then imagine that you have to arrange a truck to move your stuff and then put your stuff into boxes. And if you have kids, I don't know, do you have kids?
No, I don't know.
Well, if you have kids, tell them that they have to go to a different school and then... Okay, you have to start at whatever 8 at the club, but you also have to tell your kid, okay, you're going to your new school today. Kid cries. You don't have the time for all that. Yeah, if you go into details, it's really impactful.
Yeah, and imagine if the kid moving schools is moving to a school that everybody there speaks a completely different language. So it's a really big thing that people on the outside probably underestimate and don't factor that in when they expect players to arrive and perform from the minute that they land.
It's your job. You pay $25 million. Why don't you perform? Yeah, you don't see what's going on in his life. Maybe he's even in a forum by himself.
Exactly. And that happens regularly. It's very rare that it all moves seamlessly and the whole family move together and everything. They move immediately into a house that they can call home. That's not the reality of how it works, unfortunately.
How do you try to deal with that as a coach? Because at Norwich, I don't know if you had a lot of transfers this summer, probably from foreign players coming in. How do you deal with that?
Norwich have been terrific with a couple of signings that we've made this summer in particular, that non-English speaking players where we've had to bring in an interpreter. Who's outstanding, I have to say, and I'm very envious of his ability to speak different languages. And he's translating for both players at the same time. and one speaks Portuguese and one Spanish speaking. So his ability to do that is incredible. So that's the first step. The club also has people employed to look after,
sure.
After their welfare, and these particular things in terms of accommodation and helping players settle, even to like transport, like organizing for them to have a car, to get around, to get to training every day, to arrive at games. So the club takes care of a lot of aspects of this. But then on a more human level, away from logistics, it's trying to make them feel comfortable, trying to make it feel like a home away from home. You're never going to get that. But trying to make them comfortable in the surroundings, trying to make them feel loved and part of the club. There's obviously reasons why these players have been brought in, on a football level. So they've got attributes that the team can benefit from. So it's highlighting those and making them feel comfortable that you're here to be you. And we brought you here because you've got qualities that we can all learn from, use, and you can excel at in our environment. So yeah, that comfortableness, and trying to make sure that they feel part of it, hopefully in the first few weeks, makes them reassured that they've made the right decision. Wherever they've moved from, it's a big move, and you're trying to make sure that they feel like they've made the right decision in those early stages, really.
Yeah, and an interpreter helps extremely in communication, but it also, if you talk one-to-one to a person and there's somebody in between, maybe he has to bring over the emotion, or he kind of has to feel what you are saying as well, which makes it also a little bit harder. But also, is he also on the pitch, the interpreter?
Yeah, he is, yeah. And that's an essential part of his role, really. Some of the practices that we do in terms of explaining rules and how things work, without the interpreter, actually, and it's a flaw in myself that I can't speak those languages well enough to communicate with those players properly. I am learning at least one major language, and I know parts of others, but I'm certainly not as skilled as the interpreter, and without him, the players will be lost within the sessions, and that would frustrate them, it would frustrate the other players, and ultimately we wouldn't get very far. So I have to say his work is so important.
It I can imagine for you it's also an adjustment, because I've been in Japan one time, and I also had an interpreter, and he was kind of my shadow. But I had the urge when I coached to step into the pitch, let's say on spontaneous moments, and then just coach. And then I kind of have to think, okay, not more than one or two or three sentences, because otherwise this guy has to translate 30 minutes or 30 seconds of content or whatever, which is not going to work. So that's also balancing your own actions at that point.
It is, but I think one of the skills of a great coach anyway is to try and make the complex as simple as possible. Sure. So actually, when you speak through an interpreter, that is one of the things that you have to do. You have to be really succinct with what's the message that I want him to hear, and how simply can I give that to the translator to then send across.
Yeah.
I have to say I see it as a challenge myself. So I do try and use the translator to learn some of the key phrases, the key words, because I just think that it's about learning this, and I do quite like learning myself anyway, and for my own benefit. But then I've always worked off the premise that if I make mistakes in trying to communicate with him, he feels okay to make mistakes communicating back with me. And ultimately we want these players to be able to communicate with the other players. So they're going to have to learn English.
Yeah.
So by starting from a base of, I'll meet you halfway, I'll make lots of mistakes and you can laugh at me if you like, and making it a comfortable environment where they're not feeling nervous or on edge to try and communicate back in our language. I see that as an important role that I take on, in terms of it's okay to make mistakes and it's okay to fail, and we can laugh about it and we can joke about it And it's okay. It's safe. It's safe to do that. And that translates then, I hope, to what happens on the grass. It's got to be an environment where players feel safe when they come to work, that they can try things, they can experiment with things, they can fail at times. And so long as learning takes place and that we all get better from it, then that's the kind of environment and atmosphere that we want to create anyway. Yeah. So I've tried to set that as a tone in these interactions that I've had with these players that have more recently signed.
Yeah. But in the end, it's the goal, very clear, by the way, and I completely agree. Not only in language, but in everything, I think that's what you mean. Also in your actions or being proactive or if you're an attacker, just daring to do stuff or whatever. I think that's also what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the environment needs to be safe where people feel like they can be themselves. Yeah. And you only get to be the best version of yourself, which is sort of something I believe in. That's what we're all trying to be, the best version of who we are, and the skills and qualities and attributes that we've got. How do we make them as good as we possibly can? You only get there by testing them, by failing, by refining it. And that's the same for language as it is for what happens on the grass. Unless you're prepared to attempt to go past somebody in a 1v1 situation, we're never going to find out what does work for you and what doesn't work for you and where we need to refine your techniques or skills in order to make you more successful at doing that.
Yeah.
So it's a mindset thing, really.
Yeah. After 10 minutes, I think we're also in a safe conversation now. So now I can ask you the hardest questions that I prepared you for.
Oh, okay.
No, it's about your coach's room.
Yeah.
Because, well, of course, we're called inside the coach's room and every coach has his own office. I'm interested how you're situated with the staff and then if you can pick one item or something that has the most value to you.
It's a really difficult question, this, to say one thing. Coaching's so multifaceted. We talked here at length for 10 minutes about languages and communication and that's one facet that is hugely important, and I don't think you can underestimate. You can talk about relationships. I think the one thing, though, having spent some time thinking about this question when you preempted me with it, I think the thing all those things come back to for me is clarity. I think the one thing that you need inside your coach's room is clarity. So in all aspects of coaching, what's the message that we want to send? And that could be to the team, it could be to the unit, it could be to the individual. Amongst ourselves, what's the message that we're all united behind? And I think there needs to be clarity for that message to be dispersed between the number of people that are involved in a football club.
Okay, very clear. So that's also clarity. where do you start then? If clarity is so important, where does it start?
I suppose it starts before recruitment, really. So I'm very fortunate to work currently at a football club where the level of recruitment and research that's gone into the people that are currently working there. There we start from a basis of sharing values. So in terms of clarity, there are some unwritten rules, I suppose, that we all as people believe in. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been brought all under the same umbrella at Norwich City.
Just a very, really quick question. If clarity is, I don't know if you said it on purpose, but if it's very important that everything is on the same page, why is it unwritten? Or is it also written?
It is written. It is written, but I would like to think that the best environments, you wouldn't actually have to write that down.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
Because it's more important that those things are acted. So it's more about behaviors
okay, I understand.
Than what's written. Don't get me wrong, it is written down. And I think in any organization, I've spent a lot of time in academies, and I've gone to other academy buildings to play fixtures and things. And you always see these things on the wall, but it's not the words on the wall that matter. It's the behaviors and it's the actions. And there's a feeling, and you know, when you're in and around like-minded people, you have a feeling, and that feeling allows you to be yourself. And you can air opinions, you can air views, because you feel comfortable that, okay, I'm with like-minded people here. And I think that massively helps with the clarity piece. So there's almost those unwritten rules that are written, that are on the wall.
Yeah, I understand.
But they're lived and breathed. And then it's about deciding, well, what do we stand for then? How do we want to go about our work? What do we want our work to say about us? So every time that the team step onto the pitch and play, they're a reflection of everybody at the football club. What do we want that to look like? And then working back from that. So that's the end point. How do we get there? And then that's planning the journey. And every step along that, there needs to be clarity. So where are we? Where are we trying to go next? Who do we need to speak to? What work do we need to do with the team, the unit, the individual, in order that this piece moves forward? And every day, hopefully, we're taking steps towards the utopia of what we want this group to look like and represent us like.
Yeah, okay. Very clear again. And I really like the way that the foundation is in the end, the identity of the club and how it reflects on the pitch. Because I have the feeling, and it's a feeling, that a lot of clubs have a playing style, or they have principles, and they have an identity or an history, but that it is not always connected. So I don't know literally the details of or the identity of Norwich, but for example, if you have a club that is from, let's say, a town where a lot of people have to work very hard for their living, and it's a tough town, and then you want to be this elegant first team which plays the perfect football, there's no relationship between that and the people. These people want to see players that work their fucking ass off, because that's what they do every day. I have the feeling that what you're sharing is that there's a true connection, because this is who we are and this is what it represents on the pitch. And then I think that's the strongest foundation, and then it doesn't have to be written, because it's in the feeling of everybody that walks around there.
Yeah, and that's the long-term ambition, that people can see a reflection of what they want to see on the pitch, to work towards this. And there will be setbacks in it. So there will be times where it gets really tested and it comes undone, and then we have to look at it, refine it, learn from it, move forward. Same things that I spoke about in terms of the mistakes that you make when you're conversing with someone in a different language. The team makes those mistakes. So then it's, well, okay, fine, it's happened. How do we then rectify it so that same mistake doesn't happen again? And as you start moving forward, sometimes you take three or four steps forward and there's half a step back, and then you go again. And some of those moments where, oh, okay, we've come undone here today, and it's not been ourselves that we've seen out there, and certainly not the version that we want everyone to see of us. In those moments, sometimes they can be the things that propel you four or five steps down the road, where actual good performances and things going well, they take you one step forward each time.
Yeah.
So it's not always the end of the world when there's hurdles in the way and things come unstuck a little bit, because in those moments people have to reflect, and people tend to reflect more in those moments than when things are going well.
Was for Norwich the relegation such a hurdle?
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose from our coaching team's point of view, in some of those games, we learned some real truths about our team. what we were capable of, where our shortcomings were. What makes it really difficult is that there's no quick fixes to those things. And the Premier League was such an unforgiving league. If you were lacking in certain areas, it just felt like every week we were getting exposed with those things. And the games come thick and fast. The one thing I would like to say has been a real benefit for me personally, has been that we've had a solid pre-season. We've had 5 weeks where we've been able to plan where we want the games to be.
You mean this season?
For this season.
Yeah, because just to give some context for everybody, you came in with the staff halfway last season, right? So there was no preparation. You were just, okay, there was a coach fired. You and the team, or you, not you, the team stepped in, the coaching team stepped in, and you were also hired in that process. And then you're all of a sudden you're in 2 games a week, and there's no time to think. There's only time to work.
Yeah. So having had 5 weeks this year of being able to try and plan our own program, we've been able to control the games that we want to play. Where do we want them to be? What level of opposition do we want them against? So that we can work more strategically. When you come into a club mid-season and the season's already going and the games are already on top of you, I think my first game was 3 days after I joined. You just don't get that preparation time to embed any of the work that you want to embed. The principles that you want to put in and that you want the scene to play to, that you just don't have the time to do that. So certainly from a learning perspective, yes, last season was tough. We learned a lot about our group. This year, with a 5-week pre-season program, a chance to embed the principles that we want our team to show and display, it hopefully has put us in a much better position.
Yeah. What was your biggest lesson from those 4 months in the pressure cooker without any preparation?
I think how quickly the game can change at that level. How quickly and adaptable teams can be to the problem that you're trying to give them. So for example, you may set up your team to press in a specific way against a certain opponent. And for the first, certainly in academy football, that solution that that problem that you're giving them, it might take them certainly until half time to rectify that. And they might need some coach intervention to solve that. In the level of the Premier League, it moves so quickly. So you might be able to do that twice, but then the third time, they'll have worked it out.
Yeah.
So they'll then come up with the solution to that, which means now you've got to then adapt and come up with something different. And it was just the speed at which that moved that was very different to what I'd experienced in the past. And I certainly wouldn't want to be faced with that lack of preparation in that environment again, if it was at all possible.
Yeah. So if I think out loud, you're Norwich, you're one of the bottom teams, so struggling, trying to find a solution every week, and then you play, let's say, top five team, and only one individual with his own talent can create a solution for a problem that you created as a team, because he's so skillful, he can just fix it on his own and he doesn't even have to involve a coach, other players, whatever, because he's so good.
Yeah.
It kind of disrupts your whole program. And in youth academy or youth football, or maybe U23, they're more looking towards the sideline. Okay, we're stuck with this plan. How do we solve it? And then halftime is the first time that it really gets solved. But here, If Mohamed Salah says, okay, they're covering the inside a little bit too much, let's go on speed on the outside and the problem is solved. It takes 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think when I think about the teams that were the quickest to adapt, they'd had some longevity to the coaching staff that were at those clubs. So again, going through the process that I spoke about before, you have your principles, you work towards them. In those moments where the opposition throw things at you that you come unstuck in, they're actually the moments where the team learns the most. So, well, if we face that again, we would do this. we go along for a few games and everything's great. And then suddenly we come unstuck because this team have done that and that's caused us a big problem and we've not had the solution to deal with it. Okay, if that happens again, these are the solutions that we could use to maybe better counteract that. The teams that I'm talking about that actually moved the fastest in terms of adjustments like that were the ones that have gone through that process. Certainly, that's my guess from the outside. Sure. Because the longevity of the head coach and the staff would suggest that they've probably had those bumps. And over a course of time, you as a team within your system and with your players and the relationships that they have, they work out, okay, in that scenario, we do that. In that scenario, we'll do this. In that scenario, we'll do this. And then it becomes really slick, really fast, and really difficult to deal with. And what we didn't have last year was we didn't have that process in place when the games were coming for us. So the games probably came around too fast and too quickly without us being able to embed those principles that we would have liked the players to be able to interpret and then find solutions with.
Yeah. Also something that is good to know for outsiders. Okay. If you step in to a new club, the one thing that you don't have is literally time enough in a day. Because you want to, first you have to get to know everybody literally. From players to chef to whoever runs around at the complex or the facility, and then learn how the team plays, make players feel comfortable again, because maybe in that phase, especially when you're in the bottom, a coach is sacked, whatever, players can feel also unsafe. So everything you have to turn upside down, and you only have one day a week to maybe evaluate the last game and then move up to the next. It's very hard.
Yeah, and then you have to, it's not just the time, it's the cost of anything that you do. So with the games, the actual work that you want to do on the pitch, that comes at a cost. So if you think about a car, for example, you need the car to be topped up and in prime condition for the race on Saturday. Everything that you do in the lead up to that has a cost implication. So you don't want to take too much away from the car in the leading days up to that. Yeah. Because you want the car to be able to perform. So it's a really fine balance and trade-off as to, well, actually, how much can we do here? And then you have to be innovative and try and find ways to integrate your work, to do video work, to have one-to-ones, to try and get that. But across the board, it's some players need to feel it. And to do that, you've got to be on the grass and you've got to present them with the pictures to work through those solutions. So it is a time element, but it's also a cost.
Yeah.
How much of this can we actually do here without impacting their performance on a Saturday?
Yeah, so that's the thing that you have to do there is choose. Choose every, let's say, week or maybe even every 2-3 days. Okay, what do we do?
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. Okay, and back to clarity, because I think it's a nice subject that we kind of make the subject of this this podcast. In that first, what's the difference, let's say, in those first months and now? Because clarity is almost the foundation of everything you do. Everybody has to speak the same language. How do you make sure, maybe last season in those short 4 months, to get everybody on the same page or everybody in the same direction? And now you had more time. And what's the biggest difference? And how do you create? How did you create the clarity in that preseason to really have a clear? Well, again, I'm going to repeat this word 100 times, but okay. To get a really clear vision to your players.
See, clarity is important, right?
Well, it's if you tag it every time. No, but you're right.
So I suppose what we did this season was we tried to, we had a, a number of principles that we wanted to embed. We've tried to condense those into as few principles as possible. But the principles encapsulate the whole team performance that we want them to create. So again, in terms of simplicity, common sense, but 12 principles or four? Four is much easier to remember. It's much easier to get that kind of clarity from four than it is from 12. So trying to condense the principles into real key things. What are the biggest things that we're going after that we want this team to reflect back when they play? And then showing them. And I suppose the strength of having the games last season was that we were able to, okay, here's the good elements of our performances. Here's where you're showing us that you're capable of implementing the principles that we want you to play to. And all we're asking you to do is do this more often. So modeling was a big thing that we used in pre-season. It was modeling of them to try and build confidence that and belief, because that's a big thing. Whenever you're trying to change something or implement something, getting belief in it is a real big thing. So them seeing themselves doing it at the highest level against the very best was something that we thought would really impact them and gain belief in what we're trying to do. Then it was about having, from those principles, it was about having a common language so that when we need to adjust very quickly in games, it's a very quick instruction to, okay, and this isn't from coach to player. Sometimes this is player to player. And one key phrase of three or four words could impact the whole team to change something very quickly. Whether that's a pressing strategy, whether that's the way that we're going to build, whether that's a rotation perhaps of a certain kind. But having a common language for those specific things means that we can move at the speed that we need them to move when it comes to the game situations. And then it's repetition. It's repetition of those things over and over and over again until they become second nature. So, I mean, I've pinched clarity out of a phrase that I quite like in terms of what I think players need. I think they need clarity. So I think they need to know what you're expecting of them. I think they need consistency. And I think they need repetition. And I think that's how they get better at their job and functioning as part of the team in the way that you would like to see them play.
Clear. How does it show during a week or during your coaching? How do you create, I can imagine, okay, the words that you use need to be very consistent. That's already one thing.
Yeah.
Is it also that, okay, in the first, how do you show it in, let's say, these first, I'm thinking out loud here, sorry. How practically during a week does these three elements show? Can you give an example?
If we work backwards, so repetition, we repeat practices. The practices that we used in pre-season are still the ones that we're using now. So regardless of opponents and what they're potentially doing, a large part of the week is repetition of our practices to reinforce the way that we want our team to play. Then within those practices, the repetition of message and language will be exactly the same. And over the course of time, you're hoping that those things start to catch on. And one of the things as a coach that then becomes really powerful is when you hear that being said from player to player. So they almost become a coach of other players within the team, without you needing to be there. And I suppose utopia for me has always been that I wouldn't want to say this to Norwich City, but you coach to try and make yourself redundant. So all this work that you're doing behind the scenes on a daily basis is to try and get the players to take over and be comfortable and capable of doing it without your help and without your assistance. Some games, they need more of your help. Sometimes you can offer less. So the repetition on a daily basis and that focus on can you help each other and be a good teammate, which is something that, that the manager, the head coach here talks about a lot, is how to be a good teammate. Those things are repeated on a daily basis. The consistency comes because we're using the same practices. So we're not reinventing the wheel from one week to the next. This is how this opponent plays, so we're going to do X, Y, and Z. And then suddenly next week, the opponent plays differently, so we're going to use A, B, and C. It's not like that. There are adjustments based off our principles, not wholesale changes. And then to then lead back to, that then gives clarity that, well, everything's the same. So hopefully on a weekly basis, it's just a continuing cycle of development for us, as opposed to planning and preparing for individual games.
Yeah. I hope
that was clear enough.
Well, that was very clear again. I wish I've had the discussion, let's say 8 years ago, because when I became a head coach, I've told this many times in the podcast, but I tend to adjust a lot on the opponent, which on short term worked very well because I got a team that was that had a clear playing style for 3 years, so I could build on that. So if I would change something towards an opponent, the foundation was still there. But I noticed over long term that I lacked in developing or lacked in developing a consistent playing style. So therefore, when we had more initiative in games, let's say in the second half of the season, our principles were gone. So I think it's very interesting that you say that okay, we don't adjust, we just use the principles that we have, which is being consistent, I think, with what you mean, by solving the problems that an opponent gives us. And I think that's very valuable for coaches to learn, because I thought, okay, I have this great team and we did pretty well, but they now playing with 4-4-2, or they're playing with 3-5-2, whatever, and I adjusted every time. But it in the long run, it didn't help. So that's something I hear from your story as well.
Yeah.
Coaches, sorry for the interruption, but besides the coaches room, I run another company called Football Tours. This is a full service touring company, and we organize pre-season and winter training camps for professional football teams. We do this for both senior and youth teams, and we take care of everything: hotel, training accommodation, friendly matches, whatever you need. Also, we give youth teams the opportunity to train at the best youth academies of the Netherlands. Academies like PSV, Feyenoord, AZ Alkmaar and the KNVB, you can train there with your team. So, if you are a professional coach, you need to organize your training camp. Or if you have a youth team and you want to train at the best facilities and the best academies of the Netherlands, go to footballtours.com. And now pay attention, tours is with a Z. So footballtours.com.
These are just things that I believe in. One of the great things about football is that there are lots and lots of different ways of being successful. So whilst I'm a believer in long-term development of a game model and a way of playing for a team, sometimes there are occasions where actually you need to just find a way week to week to survive. And I'm not against that at all. There will be periods where that's absolutely necessary. And there are coaches who believe in that and have been very, very successful at doing that. So I would never say that to anybody that this is the definitive way of doing anything. It's just the way that I like to work and the way that I believe I can try and impact something and be successful with it.
Yeah. Okay. I understand. Is that because before we pressed record, I was already saying that I was impressed with your long career for a 30-year-old. Is this something that you developed, let's say, throughout this 19 years of coaching?
Yeah. So, experiences in my own work. So in England, the impact of the ECCC probably aligned itself with
what is that?
The way that
what is that?
The Elite Player Performance Program.
Okay.
Elite Player Performance Plan. Sorry. So basically, it was introduced by the Premier League to try and improve standards in academy coaching. What it did was, in essence, it held clubs accountable to what is your program, how are you trying to play, and then what is your coaching program to support that. It probably helped me as a coach because my background at the start of my coaching career was working for a private company, and the guy that I worked for was the coach that actually coached me in university football. And he was an ex-teacher. So he'd almost shown me a way of working that required a syllabus and a coaching program and a structured way of working. And over the course of a 6-week period or a 12-week period or a yearly program, there'd be certain outcomes that you would expect to see. So that was my first exposure to coaching. So seeing in the early part of my career, seeing some unstructured work was a bit different for me. Then obviously the Premier League's introduction of the ECCC, where each club had to say, this is our program, this is how it works, this is the playing style. Again, clarity being a big thing for me, that really helped because I knew where the players were coming from and the level of knowledge and understanding they should have. And I knew where I was trying to get them to support the next part of their journey. And then obviously over time, I've had various different experiences at Aston Villa and now at Norwich. Outside of that, I've traveled a lot to find out about methodology at different places. So we spent a large part of the time that I did my UEFA Pro license at a course called the Elite Coaches Award that the FA ran, traveling around to see different clubs in this country and abroad. And then stepped outside of that to look at other sports and businesses and learned an awful lot in that time about how you lead people, how you get people to buy into a program.
Something that you picked up there?
So one of the biggest things I took from an advertising agency, some conversations with a guy called Kevin Roberts at Saatchi & Saatchi, was the four things that people want, and that he believed people responded to. So responsibility, anybody that comes to work, they want responsibility. Yeah. They want recognition when they do well. They want to learn. And then ultimately there has to be some joy about going to work. And if you give and get all four of those things, then that produces an environment where people thrive. That was the ultimate message that he was giving behind those four things. So even in something like advertising, which is quite far removed from sport and from football, there was a lot to take from those conversations, because then he would talk about how he does that, how he structures it. So they were fascinating conversations. Spending time in Spain at both Madrid clubs, at Barcelona, we went to Ajax, went to Juventus, went to Paris Saint-Germain to see how they work with their players. Just gleaning different things from different places. The idea of a really defined game model, I would have to say Spain was a big one in terms of my visits there. They were very clear around in each moment of the game, this is what we expect our team to do. And then very clear in their coaching program as to how they were going to go about getting that. and rehearsing that, because ultimately that's what training is. It's a rehearsal for the performance. Unfortunately, unlike the theatre, there's another team trying to destroy your performance every week. And it's about how do you find a way to uphold your performance despite what they might try and do to you.
Okay. Very, very, again, very clear, and also very interesting that you, because while I wrote the responsibility, recognitions, learning and joy, I wrote down, and you can immediately think, you can imagine, okay, this is a discussion with a marketing guy, but you can immediately transfer them to your football context and say, okay, this responsibility means that players can make their own decisions. They want to be recognized for what they do, whether it's a first 11 player, or you could also think about player 12 to 15, whatever. It's very easy to transfer this to any work situation, any sport or whatever. So it's very interesting to hear these four words.
Absolutely. And I suppose to give you a couple of live examples, you can give the responsibility to one of your defenders for the depth of the back line. It's your responsibility to control the depth of our last line of defense. With that then comes the recognition when he gets it right that, hey, well done, terrific. You're in exactly the right position here, in relation to the ball, in relation to the current moment. Equally though, it's easy to give responsibility and recognition to the ones that are playing every week. You then need to find a way of, the players that aren't playing, how do you find a way to recognize their contributions? So I think it's important that when you're practicing and training during the week, that you recognize actually like his performance today is making you a better player, which allows you to play more effectively when it comes to playing against the opposition on a Saturday, which I hope brings a whole collective performance during the week. So one thing that I do say regularly to players is that we want our toughest opponent to be here on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, not turn up on a Saturday and play against us. So trying to get that recognition for players that aren't playing in the team is a big thing that I took from those conversations. Everybody needs and requires that. So how do you find ways to recognize the contribution of players who aren't necessarily contributing for 90 minutes on the pitch? We've been in a position recently where in a couple of games, we've relied on players coming into the game that haven't started the game, and they've had a real impact. And that's given us an opportunity to recognize the contribution of the players that don't start the game, because it's not always the 11 that start the game that actually have the biggest impact on it. Some of the finishers that come on are equally, if not more important. Tactically, the game's different when they enter, and they might have skills and qualities that actually are better suited to that moment of games than the ones that potentially start it.
Yeah, well, I completely agree, and I think that's also the future of football, but it's completely different discussions where you get more and more specialists throughout, because you now already have five substitutes, which differs, of course, from three, where you're more reserved in your, or reactive maybe in your substitutions, and now you can be more proactive and you can base your strategy almost on your substitutions. And even when they are going to allow even more substitutes or even rotate players, which is, could be something in the future, this is going to be even a bigger factor.
Yeah. So one of the things that happens now is you're trying to predict what might happen in the game before it starts. So how might this game play out? What will the first 20 minutes be like? What will then the first half look like? What will it be like up until sort of 60, 70 minutes? And then what will the last 20 or 30 minutes look like? And then from that, your personnel then start to come into, well, actually he would be best suited to doing this at that moment. So yeah, I could definitely see it becoming even more strategic in terms of who starts and who potentially ends and finishes games.
Yeah, yeah, it's a very interesting discussion. Also, if you look at roles and maybe even offensive coaches, defensive coaches, you're going more towards the game gets bigger, I think.
Yeah.
The role of the coaching staff gets bigger. It's there are more choices, it becomes much more interesting. And okay, again, it's completely different discussion about should the game change or not or whatever, but it's inevitable that it will change. It's a great challenge for all coaches out there to think, okay, how is the game going to evolve?
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? If you start to think about how games might unfold. So I guess substitutions once upon a time were just in case somebody got injured. Now they've become a lot more strategic and a lot more tactical in their makeup. And I think having so many choices available, it then leads to like quite big discussions at times in terms of, well, okay, we could do this, we could do that, we could do this. And it's about trying to in-game find the right one at the right moment.
How many players do you have on a bench? How many allowed?
It depends on the competition. So some competitions it's seven and some competitions it's nine.
Yeah. Okay. So that gives, so five substitutions, seven or eight, nine players to choose from. It's a lot of choices.
Yeah.
Great. And I can imagine that's also something that really changed your coaching role from being an academy coach and being more development style, having young kids or young adults and bringing them towards professional football and also yourself. And now you're there and now it's all about, not all about, but performing and making these strategic choices to win games is now a much bigger part of the game, of your role, than let's say 5 years ago.
Yeah, although I still see a first team as a development job. I still see that the team can develop and the individuals within it can develop. So I wouldn't say that my approach to coaching has changed at all. Okay. In fact, because I think if you make each individual 5% better, then how much better is the team? But there is obviously an emphasis on, well, we have to also get results along the way. But it's a belief of mine, that results are a consequence of long term, they're a consequence of the work that you do. And if you can get players to individually improve, collectively improve, and as a team and a squad improve, then results are a byproduct of good work, in my opinion.
Yeah. Also again, I the words always in my head are clear, very clear. But it's also a very clear story, and it connects also again with your clarity and consistency, I think, mainly this part. It developing your, even though you're on the highest level or now you're in championship level, still elite level of football, that consistently developing yourself, your players, is going to lead to a good performance.
Yeah, and one thing that I need to be sort of clear about really is that this doesn't mean, whilst I'm saying that there's clarity and that we're consistent, that doesn't mean there's an unadaptability. We are adaptable. I am adaptable, and there are things that we will adapt based on what's needed in that moment. But I think you can teach in a way that you almost give them, within the principles, you're giving the players and the group a menu. And in each game and in each moment, it's their responsibility to choose what's necessary. So we'll give you the menu. We'll teach you that. We'll give you the repetition of that. We'll give you the clarity of that. And then in the moment, you need to see it, you need to feel it, and then you need to make your decisions based on what you've seen. But over a period of time, you would hope that the habits that have been ingrained will mean that without actually consciously thinking about it, they would choose the right thing at the right time.
Yeah, because it's installed in their thinking, choice-making, whatever, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Again, very clear. Okay, well, I have to say we horribly failed, Liam, because we're already 55 minutes in. And I again told my guest, no, I'm aiming for 45 minutes, which I never make, but okay. But we're going towards the last question. We didn't discuss it before we started, but I did think I sent it to you. Who should we talk to next? Did you think about that?
I did have a brief think about this. I haven't actually spoken to this person, so I'm going to drop him in it, and we'll make contact with him and see if he would be willing to do one of these. One of the people I work closely with and I've spent the longest time working with would be a guy called Neil Winskill, who is the head of coaching at Newcastle United's academy. The trips that I talk about and the people that we went to see and speak to, he did a large number of those with me. We don't think exactly the same on everything, so it wouldn't just be a repeat of this podcast. There'd be things that Neil would be able to share with you from his experience and his beliefs that I think your listeners would find really interesting. He's a very intelligent guy with a lot of experience. He's worked with a lot of different players, and he'd be able to give you some real insights, I think.
Great. Well, we would love to talk to him. Let's see if we can get him on. And yeah, he's also in an interesting environment at this point with the club going through a lot of changes.
Yeah, and he's recently moved from his previous role was working with players. His new head of coaching role, which he's been doing now for a couple of years, he's now actually working inside the coaches' room, but with coaches. So he's heavily in coach development as opposed to player development in a role such as mine. So from a coach education perspective, which is the aim of the podcast, I think he would be able to empathize with the coaches and the journey they're on and be able to perhaps drop some nuggets of information in there that people would really benefit from.
Great. Well, now I'm even more convinced that we should have him on. So thank you for the nomination.
No problem at all.
Let's see if we can make that work. And I really want to thank you for your appearance.
Anytime at all. I've enjoyed it. And I hope, I just hope that there's something in there that people can go away and use and they find useful, really, because a lot of people have helped me on my journey, and it's little bits of information that make a big difference to the way that you work on a day-to-day basis. And as with the Kevin Roberts thing, it's something that stuck with me. So hopefully there's something in there that somebody finds useful.
I wrote several nuggets down, so I have a page. So I think everybody that can pick something. That's a good thing that what you're saying, actually, is that if you go, I'm not saying that it's about this podcast, but anything, if your mind said, okay, maybe I pick up one thing. If it's only one thing, then you're going to find that one thing. If you're going to be a listener that's going to sit there and, okay, let's see what these guys have to talk. They have to convince me that they say something that is valuable. Then you're not going to pick up on anything. If you're just open, and then you can learn from literally anybody.
Anybody, anytime.
Great, great. Okay, great closure on this. Thanks. And thank you for all your clarity. It was very
cool. No problem.
Thanks, Liam. Speak soon.
Speak to you soon. Bye.
Bye-bye. If you like this episode, share it with your colleagues, share it with friends, share it on social media, like, subscribe, do whatever you do best and help us grow. Because the bigger we are as a podcast, the bigger and the more inspirational names we can invite to inspire you. And do not forget to pick up your 14-day free trial at thecoachesroom.com. With your free trial, you have access to all our masterclasses, both the live ones and the on-demand ones. Coaches from top European academies share their knowledge and you can watch it. So go to thecoachesroom.com and pick up your 14-day free trial.